This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Health and Living on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng, sitting in for Meera Sivasodhi because of Deepavali week. And joining me is Health and Living producer Tina Kamrilia as we try to tackle a challenging, contentious, but hopefully compelling topic, genome editing. And in the studio for her seventh installment of Brainwaves is neurogeneticist Dr. Aslina Anwar to help acquaint us with genome editing. Welcome, Doctor. For me, editing of any sort, being an occasional writer, I think of editing as I have written something out, then I don't quite like it, I rearrange words, I delete words. Now, I'm going to use it as my analogy, sure, so that you can help me understand this.
That's a
what
good
is genome editing?
Okay, so I mean, like you said, it is very similar to working, let's say, on a Microsoft Word. And you have written an article and you have made a typo, let's say, and before the times when they had the autocorrect, and you want to go back and you want to search and replace, for example. So maybe things that you, a particular word you want in bold, so you can search for it and then you can replace it. So it's the same thing when you do genome editing. It's what we call a molecular toolkit, just a fancy term really to mean that you have these proteins that you can use to do the search and to do the replacing as well.
How do you go about doing that? I know Microsoft Word, I shouldn't be giving Microsoft so much attention, but using the Word editor, you know, you find the word, you just cut it off. I mean, you just hit the delete button. What's your delete button?
So the delete button is molecular scissors. So you have, it's like a pair of scissors that you can go in and you can cut the DNA. And then you have another piece of DNA and other proteins that come in and sort of guide the new piece of DNA that you want to edit in. And then it sort of puts it in the right place and makes sure everything is correct. And then that's it.
Your molecular scissors. Is it like a laser kind of thing, or you just kind of zap it? Or
it is kind of like scissors because it does cut. Yeah, it cuts the DNA.
When you're in the operating room, what do? Do you just hit a button? Is that what you do?
No. So I wish it was that simple.
Backspace.
Yeah, that's right. No. So most of the work that's being done is you take the cells from a person and then you grow it in a dish in the lab. And then you do it in the lab. And you do all the manipulation in the lab itself. And then you transfer it back into the patient. Yeah, it's not, say, in an operating room. It's done in the lab first, and then you transfer.
The human being is not anywhere near you.
It was initially, because you need to get the cells first. And then after that, you can go off in your business, and then you can come back.
What's the history of this development of this technology?
Yeah, actually, it's got a really long history, over 40 years, because the very first technology that enabled us to cut DNA was first found in about 1970s, and these are what we call restriction enzymes. So similar to how this new technology CRISPR-Cas9 works, it uses these enzymes that recognize specific parts of the DNA and then they go in and they cut it. So these restriction enzymes were found in bacteria, and the discovery of that really opened up a whole field. And we use it routinely in the lab now if you want to do any kind of insertion or, you know, genetic manipulation just to cells. So really that was the key discovery. And then along the way, there were many other kind of technologies that sort of helped. And then genome editing can also be thought of as gene therapy in a way. And gene therapy, as you know, it's been around, you know, people were sort of, they did it in the 80s and 90s.
Gene therapy would be... What exactly would be gene therapy be
right.
about?
I mean,
don't get them on a couch and talk to them or something. Like that.
Not that kind of therapy.
You can do it in the lab. You can talk to them, you know, if you're lonely. So gene therapy traditionally was that if your cells carried an abnormal gene which couldn't make the right protein that your cell needed, so what you can do is that you can actually replace that gene with the normal gene. So you would insert a normal gene into those cells so that that normal gene would then make the protein that you need. So that is sort of what they meant by gene therapy. So the earliest was really this kind of replacement. But now with genome editing, it's actually changing the patient's DNA. So before it was just putting in the protein that you replace without actually changing the person's DNA. But now it's sort of that you can actually change the DNA itself. That's what the editing part means.
You mentioned a CRISPR-Cas9. Mm-hmm. What is that?
So CRISPR is a very long name.
I just Googled it quickly. It actually stands for, it means nothing, even
what
if I tell
nothing?
You. So to the layperson, it means nothing because it stands for clustered, regularly interspaced, short, palindromic repeats. Does it explain anything to you?
No.
That's why we have the expert here.
Thank you for giving the long name. So CRISPR is a term to describe the part of the DNA that is recognized by the enzyme Cas9. So Cas9 is actually the scissors. And the tool, how do you know where to insert the new thing that you want to insert into the DNA? One way of doing it is rather than just doing it randomly, which can cause a lot of problems, you can sort of look for these sort of signature markers in the DNA, this is what they call the CRISPR, and then you then use the Cas9 and other proteins to look for these signature markers in the DNA, and then the Cas9 then comes in and cuts at those particular areas. So it increases the accuracy.
I mean, it strikes me as all very fascinating, but I still, you know, I'm trying to see in my mind's eye, what exactly, how do you cut it? Because it's not like something that's very big, and it's all done, you know, really, really, really,
yeah.
really small.
Yeah.
So how do you, you know, I know you use the analogy of a pair of scissors.
Yeah.
But
actually, DNA is very stable, but it's actually quite easy to break up as well. So if you were to extract someone's DNA and you put it into what we call a vortex, so you spin it really rapidly for a long time,
what
happens is the DNA just breaks. So it's not like, you know, you're drilling. It's actually quite easy to cut, yeah.
Now, genome editing, what's it used for? I assume then it's because something is, like in writing, if it's not quite smooth or it's not quite well, you edit it.
Mm. Yeah, so actually there are four possible uses for genome editing. So one is what they call somatic therapy. So for example, if you had a form of muscular dystrophy whereby your muscles don't have the normal set of proteins to keep them healthy and functional, so you can insert. So if you carry the abnormal form of that gene, so you can replace it with the normal form so that you can make the right protein so your muscles are healthy. And then, of course, then you have this germline therapy whereby you can sort of work on embryos and change their mutant genes or their abnormal genes to avoid getting serious genetic disorders. And so those are done at very early stage embryos. And then you have the more kind of controversial part, which is when people talk about enhancement. So they call it somatic enhancement. So like I said, if it's possible to replace a protein in the cell to make that muscle healthier, then you could kind of theoretically use the same technology on a healthy person to enhance his muscles. So that would be the
stronger
same technology.
Muscles.
That's right. That's right. And then you would have similarly germline enhancement, whereby you could work on very early embryos and not those that carry these serious genetic disorders. But again, you can change either the muscles or you can change, let's say, their eye color, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so the genome editing, there are many possible uses. Yeah.
When I edit, I always want to make my prose better.
Right.
So I suppose there is this kind of genome editing to make genomes better.
That's right, yeah.
Don't
yeah.
give this technology to Sun Heng.
But how widespread is it being used?
Actually, the technology itself in cells and in animals is quite widespread. But the reason why sort of a lot of people are talking about it now and why we're talking about it today is because people have started using it on human embryos, where previously we didn't go to that area. But actually, the technology itself is very widespread. You can use it in bacteria; nobody really cares. But then, when you start talking about
using,
you know,
it for human beings,
human embryos, then everybody gets.
Is it used in the agricultural industry?
Sure. Yeah.
And nobody really cares.
It could be used, yeah. And you know, I mean, if you think back at the time when people were talking about, you know, GMO, genetically mm-hmm. modified organisms, there was a big outcry then.
That's right.
And then it sort of died down a little bit, and so if you sort of read some of the comments that the scientists who did all these discoveries, they also feel that because it's new technology, people are worried. But they also think that over time and over the public understanding better about the technology and what it means, then, you know, the kind of anxiety might give way a little bit.
At this stage, how much of this is being done on human embryos in Malaysia?
Oh, in Malaysia? Okay. In Malaysia, as far as we know, it hasn't been reported, but that's not to say that it's not being done.
How interesting.
Yeah, because actually, if you look at... So far, there have been 8 studies across the world on human embryos. So the first, of course, was in 2015, the Chinese scientists. They used these modified non-viable human embryos to try to correct a gene for thalassemia, beta thalassemia. And so that was the first report on human embryos. But since then, there have been 8. And some of those studies have been looking at trying to correct these genetic disorders. Other studies have been trying to just understand if we knock out this particular gene, how does that affect normal development? And other people have been working on it just to try to understand the technology better.
Earlier, you gave us an example that, you know, this editing could be useful in the context of somebody suffering from muscular dystrophy. Has such a thing been done?
At the moment, in terms of for the human embryos, for muscular dystrophy, no. But there have been studies on, like I said, the beta thalassemia. And then there was also a study, a slightly controversial study now, because they questioning the results on correcting a gene for a heart condition. And then there was another, and then the Chinese scientists also published another paper on thalassemia. So, but on muscular dystrophy at the moment, no. But there are rumors that, you know, people are working on it.
So you only do this at the embryonic stage. You cannot do it. Let's say I'm a child with that problem.
Yeah, so it's possible. So there are some diseases that it's easier to do. So, for example, like if you think about blood disorders, it's quite easy, and bone marrow, you know, it's quite easy to extract and then modify them in the lab and then put them back into the body. In those kinds of disorders, probably those will be the first ones that people try to tackle. And then, of course, you have other types of diseases whereby it might be a little bit more difficult to isolate that particular tissue, and how do you then put it back to make sure, you know, so for example, brain diseases. But there's also another thing about genome editing, in that it's easier to fix what are called single gene disorders, meaning that if you have a mutation in one gene, that is enough to cause a disorder, for example, like thalassemia, like cystic fibrosis, like other genetic disorders like spinal muscular atrophy and Duchenne muscular dystrophy and achondroplasia, etc., you know. But when you think about, you know, this enhancement of certain other characteristics that we have, like beauty or intelligence, actually those sort of things are controlled by many genes. And we don't quite know how do all those genes sort of collectively contribute, to what degree do they contribute. Would we have to fix all of them, or would we have to fix some of them? And so that's where, you know, at the moment for the genome editing on the human embryos, people are trying to tackle these single gene disorders because they're potentially easier to translate into clinical practice.
Now I'm going to show how ignorant I am, or and also for not paying attention in my biology class. I assume that the DNA is in every cell, right?
Every cell except the red blood cell, because the red blood cell doesn't have a nucleus.
So when you say you fix it in a petri dish and then you put it back in the body, but that's only one, whatever little you've done, how will the other cells that also carry that DNA change?
Yeah, so for example, in the case of Duchenne muscular dystrophy, all the cells will carry that mutant gene. But that mutant gene is only critical for, say, the muscle. So even if you have that mutant gene in your bone, you don't need that protein in your bone. So then you just would target the tissues that are having problems, like the muscle, and then you would replace the abnormal protein in the muscle. So you wouldn't have to target all the cells in your body.
But, you know,
that's what
I've got a lot of muscles.
Somatic therapy, so meaning just specific cells, yeah. Whereas germline therapy, if you do it early in development, then all the cells would carry. And so the thing about the germline therapy would be, if all the cells have it, then that means then you would not pass it on to the next generation. So if you wanted to offer that genome editing to a child specifically to repair the muscles, that repair would only be for that child. That when they have children later, that would not be passed on. So the anxiety that people are having is with using it in germline therapy or enhancement, because you potentially then change future generations.
When you say anxiety, it is tied to ethical questions.
Of course, yeah.
I'm talking to neurogeneticist Dr. Aslina Anwar, and we have been talking about genome editing and the CRISPR technology. Up next, the ethical debates behind such a powerful tool. This is Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to the show. I'm Lim Soon Heng. I'm with Tina Carmelia, and we are talking about genome editing with Dr. Aslina Anwar, neurogeneticist. We have talked about a bit about the history of this technology, but for me, always the interesting question, what are the ethical considerations? You have mentioned, you know, yeah, fixing somebody with muscular dystrophy, I don't think anybody would say, oh, that's not a good thing. But once you step on that line, there's also this tendency that we can step beyond that. How can we enhance our muscles? Like you say, all of us want to have blue eyes. Not sure I want to have blue eyes, but the whole notion of, yeah, I want to have babies of this sort.
Sure.
How do you decide on that? Who decides on that?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why it's important to start having these conversations. And I think, you know, a lot of the time, these conversations tend to happen in countries outside Malaysia. And I think it's important for, you know, Malaysians to also be aware of what's happening. Mm. But of course, there are many ethical issues.
Scientists playing God?
Yeah,
That would probably be the biggest.
That's the one that a lot of people say.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think when people say that? Do you think that it's possible just by using this technology?
I think it's very similar to IVF, isn't it? When it first came out, a lot of people think that you are really messing with what is natural, quote unquote.
Yeah.
But now you don't get that stigma with considering IVF, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, because when you do IVF, because it's very expensive and people do it, you know, sometimes they have to go through many different cycles. And so, you know, obviously when you implant the embryo, the fertilized embryos back, you know, you want them to be the healthiest ones. So there is already a degree of selection
in
the clinics, in the fertility clinics, you know, which is unnatural, right? So in that sense, people would say, well, you know, if that happened naturally, you wouldn't be selecting, you know, against the unhealthy embryos. So it's true, you know, people had the same concerns with IVF, but now people of all religions do it. There's no real issue.
Do we have a body in Malaysia that would decide on such a question, so that then after the discussion, the deliberation, whatever they do in terms of gathering public opinion, talk to religious bodies, and then say, here are the guidelines?
Yes, so there's the Ministry of Health, has a set of guidelines. It's similar to the kind of guidelines that was drawn out for stem cell research. How far do you do stem cell? You know, how far do you go when you do this stem cell research? So in Malaysia, there's the Ministry of Health, and then there's the Malaysian Medical Council, and then there's also the National Fatwa Committee, who decides on the Islamic point of view.
So you include in this body that makes this decision not just people from the medical profession. There you have laymen also.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Do we have people who study ethics who therefore can help?
Yes, there's a National Bioethics Committee. Yeah, who are also involved when they come up with these particular guidelines. The thing is, similar to the stem cell research that happens in Malaysia, is that it's just a guideline. It's not a law. So,
and what are the implications?
So that means, you know, if you step beyond what they tell you, you know, the guideline, you can still do it. You don't go to jail.
There are no sanctions. No sanctions.
No, it's a guideline. Whereas, for example, in other countries, there are laws. And different countries have different laws depending on many things, one of which is their religious belief. So, for example, like Ireland is very strict. They don't, you know, allow any kind of stem cell research on human cell lines or human embryos or anything.
So where are we in Malaysia with regard to this genome editing?
I think in terms of cells, so working with cells on the body, with plants, on animals.
No problems.
No problem at all. But like I said, so far there haven't been any papers that have been published from any Malaysian labs on human embryos, modifying human embryos.
Yeah. Are we getting close to doing that?
I'm sure there are people who are working on it.
Besides the ethical questions, what are some of the things that scientists are struggling with regard to genome editing?
Well, there's a lot of technological issues. So because it's so new, you don't know exactly how it works. So for example, we know that this Cas9 protein is involved, but we also know that there are other proteins that kind of help the Cas9 work. And how do you find these sort of signature markers in the genome to tell you where to cut? But how exactly do you, when you want to insert this new piece of DNA that carries the normal gene, or if you want to remove that part, all that sort of, you know, step-by-step process that still needs to be understood better. And so what happens is that in a lot of these studies that have been published already, they found that you have a lot of what they call off-target changes. So what the scientists are doing, for example, with the beta globin gene for the thalassemia, is that they only wanted to repair the beta globin gene. But what happened was that when they then looked at other parts of the genome that weren't supposed to have changed,
they changed.
There were changes. And so what people are trying to understand now is sort of, you know, how to tweak it technically to make it more accurate, and also to make, not only to make it more accurate, but also to make it more efficient, because, you know, there's no point only working in 20% of the time, or, you know.
Then it's a very high-risk procedure,
yeah,
isn't it?
Then you have a problem. Number one, it's going to be more expensive because your success rate is so low.
Those things I can understand in terms of success rate, but is it a high-risk procedure?
Yeah, that's the other thing, because you may have these off-target mutations that you have identified, but you don't quite know if it changes, what does it mean later down the line. It could have certain risks that we don't understand yet. Having said that, you know, that's why, in a way, you know, some people argue that we should allow, you know, research on these human embryos so that we know more about it, rather than burying our heads, you know, and you know, the technology is there. The technology is going to advance. And so rather than, you know, doing it and not fully understanding what's happening, we really need more research to be able to understand the pathway that's involved, all the proteins that are necessary. Because sometimes if you just work on cells in the lab, you know, that's not representative of how a human embryo will work.
Coming back to the research in China in 2015, so they reported only a fraction of the embryos had their DNA successfully introduced, quite a high number of off-target mutations. What actually happened to those embryos? Do they destroy, discard it after the experiment? So we don't have these babies running about.
Yeah, so a lot of... So there are guidelines and whereby it says that you cannot grow these embryos in the lab longer than 14 days or until what we say the presence of the primitive streak. And so the primitive streak is the very, very, very early stage of the development of the nervous system. So even before it can develop, say, you know, a spine or a early brain, well before that, people have to stop. So in the majority of the studies that have been published on these human embryos, they use what are known as non-viable embryos. So even if you let them grow, they wouldn't have grown. They wouldn't have survived. But they just sort of wanted to use them to understand, does the technology work? So there are some kind of questions whether or not, you know, using these sort of abnormal embryos was really useful anyway, because...
Right, because you don't know if it's going to be applicable to embryos that actually can develop.
But there was a recent study just a couple of months ago done in the UK where the people there used viable embryos, but they didn't allow them to grow more than a week. And those embryos they got from surplus IVF clinics, which is the kind of normal way to do it.
We've been talking in terms of genome editing and the ethical issues, but even the research itself raises ethical questions, whether you should do that kind of research and how you do that research.
Hmm? Yeah.
So even before you get to the result of, okay, we've done our research, now we can do genome editing, this research itself is in a way plagued with its own ethical questions.
Of course, yeah, because using human embryos comes with its own ethical issues. Where do you get the embryos from?
From developing countries or marginalized countries.
So normally it's the acceptable way of you doing it is people who have gone through IVF, they are offered, if they want to donate their excess embryos to research. But that is, of course, with consent. The embryos, the human embryos that are used in labs from these sort of sources.
Yeah, but consent is a funny word, though. You know, I can get all kinds of consents and then somebody down the line. I mean, the whole argument about euthanasia is also this issue, right?
Yeah.
Beyond these challenges of technology and ethical questions, what are the other issues that would keep geneticists like you awake at night?
Other issues, I think, I mean, those are the main concerns, you know. Number one, of course, you know, from a scientist point of view, if you're going to be offering this in clinical practice, you want to make sure that it's going to be of benefit and not going to pose even further risk to the patients. Because, you know, the patients are doing this almost as a kind of last resort. There is no other option, you know, and... if there was a treatment that, you know, any other treatment that they could do, but, you know, if there is no real other option, and this is a way of helping them avoid getting a serious disease, you know. And so from a scientist's point of view, we want to make sure that we're doing it accurately, that it's going to be efficient, that it's not going to pose more risk to the patient. And also, you know, what we use that technology for, also, yes, a lot of scientists have that question running through your head, but you know the technology is there, so there will be some scientists who will use it for enhancement.
How will it change public health care?
Hugely. So rather than a management approach, you know, so for example, if you think of cases of, say, like a neuromuscular disorder, like a spinal muscular atrophy, which affects children from very young, and that causes muscle weakness, progressive muscle weakness, right? And so there's no real therapy at the moment, although there is a drug that is available. Not in all countries, not in Malaysia, it's not available. But that's another story. But so how do these patients manage their condition? How do the families manage their condition? It's with physiotherapy, it's with all sorts of just cough assist, meaning that, you know, sometimes they their muscles are so weak they cannot cough. So a lot of that kind of management. And, you know, you can imagine that for the families, it's a very challenging time. And if the technology is there that you could have avoided your child getting this disease, you know, of course the families would be very excited with that option. So sometimes when people raise these sort of ethical issues and they sort of say, oh, you know, we're going down a slippery slope. If you start off with this sort of therapy, you know, in the future it's going to be enhancement and, you know, you're playing God and you're taking money away from other resources. And, you know, I challenge them to look at a patient with that condition or the parents of a child who's severely ill and say to them, your child just has to suffer and have a lifetime of pain. And because of these sort of philosophical questions of perhaps in the future, people are going to, you know, make these sort of designer babies with blue eyes and blonde hair and everything. it's very difficult.
Yeah. But public policies are formed that way, though. They don't look at the individual sure. family and the sufferer, and they're looking at cost-benefit ratios and all those kinds of measurements.
But I think that that's the whole point of having conversations like this, is to humanize these stories, isn't it? So you get people to consider it from the human perspective.
Yeah, because I think it's the same with when it was about the genetically modified organisms, right? They were worried about what's going to happen, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, there were all these sort of visions about what was going to happen in the future. But actually, you know, we're still all right, you know, and this is sort of 20, 30 years after the first sort of, you know, fears came out. And all about cloning as well. You remember when cloning came about? People were, you know, same sort of debate. But the people who have these serious genetic disorders, they're living with it now. If the technology is such that, you know, we can advance it to be able to really offer a way to avoid them having to suffer, then philosophically, should we also be saying no? You know? So
I am silenced by that.
I mean, with every new technology, it's not going to be made accessible to everyone immediately. Will this widen the gap in access to healthcare? Will it only, you know, it's not going to immediately eradicate all genetic disorders, right? So it's probably only going to be beneficial, probably only benefit the high-income bracket, for example. Do you see it causing that sort of
Absolutely.
Issue?
I mean, you could say the same thing with smartphones, right?
Yeah.
Right? It only really benefited a certain population. Only a certain population had iPhones, and then suddenly, you know, the whole world has these smartphones, you know. It really boils down to cost. Of course, everything at the beginning will be only offered to certain developed countries and only certain genetic disorders. But as the cost becomes cheaper and we know how to do it more efficiently, you know, it will potentially be able to be offered to many types of genetic disorders and hopefully filter down to all walks of life. Yeah.
How far are we from that day where we can say it's affordable and that it can be used in those kinds of diseases like muscular dystrophy?
Yeah, so I think for certain types of genetic disorders where you can replace those cells or tissues easily, at that, I think, you know, realistically, I think that's not that far away, really.
Within our lifetime?
Yeah, I would say definitely 10 years, you know, maybe less. The technology is moving so fast. But for the other conditions and diseases where we still, from a research angle, we don't know what are the genes that are responsible. What are all the genes, like these polygenic diseases, meaning that, you know, it's a contribution of many different diseases leading to that condition. So we still have to do a lot of basic research to understand that first. So offering the option to say you carry a change in your DNA that gives you a higher risk of, say, getting Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease. Are we there yet in the sense that we can change that gene and be sure that we won't get Parkinson's and Alzheimer's if we change just that? We're not quite there yet because, you know, in these sort of late onset complex disorders, just changing one gene may not be enough to really avoid developing that disease. But for these sort of single gene disorders and also those that are easy to do, like blood disorders and muscles and skin, perhaps, I'm sure it's not far away.
But please expedite some research into like Alzheimer's and all that, because I'm getting close to that place.
yeah, that's a concern for all of us. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for sharing with us, Dr. Aslina.
Sure.
That's neurogeneticist Dr. Aslina Anwar discussing genome editing and what it means to the future of healthcare.
University of Malaya and Genes for Genes Malaysia recently hosted a debate on this topic. Associate Professor Dr. Veera Sekara Natarajan argued against genome editing, while Professor Dr. Imelda Balchin argued for. Associate Professor Veera is based in UM's Department of Pathology and is head of the Transfusion Medicine Unit at UM Medical Center. And Professor Imelda is from the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Here's a condensed version of their main arguments, courtesy of Dr. Aslina Anwar.
First of all, I guess when we start off in a debate like this, it's really like going down the rabbit hole. And I'm sure for those of you who are familiar with Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. In a true Carolian sense, when we talk about going down the rabbit hole, it really refers to, for tourists, to stumbling down a bizarre, disorientating, alternate reality. And really, this is where it is going to be taking us. If you were to look at it, the phrase is equally applicable to many of what the type of endeavors that we take. When we actually go into a long free fall where we don't have a clear destination, okay, and again, you don't really have a defined destination as where all this is going to take us. And often at the end of the day, we are not able to find a way out from this burrow, and we are caught in a strange, despairing dystopian world. Again, a lot of scientific discoveries are often like that, but come out with a fairly good fairy tale ending. But nevertheless, we are not sure as to what's going to be the outcome of that. Really, if you were to look at it, who would have thought that the discovery of atom would now lead us to some strange, eccentric leader with some strange haircut, lobbing ballistic missiles over their neighbors? So, really, I guess I don't really have any qualms with scientific discovery and the advancement that comes along with scientific discoveries. Okay, I love science for that matter. But I guess then you would ask is, why would I be standing on this podium warning of where germline genome editing, and in this context, I'm really talking about germline genomic editing rather than somatic genomic editing, which is a quite different game together. Okay, the fact of the matter is that genome editing is here to stay. Okay, the fact is the train has left the station and there's nothing to stop it. Okay, but what I believe is that maybe we should not be looking at stopping it, but really stand back and relook and ask conscious questions on whether we should actually be hitching a ride on this train. Okay? The fact is, when you look back, just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should be doing it. Okay? Science does not exist in a vacuum. At the end of the day, science and developments of science has to be community-driven. Okay? And any medical interventions that is undertaken should not be only right for the individual, but should be also right for the community, because every member of society is part of the community. Okay, and if you were to look at it, the greatest exploits of humankind that have improved human quality of life has never been individualistic. When you look at things like sanitation, nutrition, vaccination, they are all community-driven, and they have probably provided much more as far as improving human quality of life than any individualistically or personally motivated therapies. So the promise of personalized, individualized treatment, despite the sexiness of it, still remains the purview of the few. Okay, the few that have money, the few that have power. And that probably constitutes probably about 10% of the entire world population, while the remaining of the population just languishes at the edges, okay, looking at these novel technologies that is not completely accessible to them. Personalized medicine such as genome editing, I think, would lead us to run the risk of further dividing the haves and have-nots. Okay? And insidiously, it will actually eventually lead the selection of the chosen few. Even more appalling is when you get these newfangled sexy technologies diverting funds from and attention from actual societal needs, and when you actually allow commercial entities to gain money out of an endeavor like this, is really very, very dangerous. Yeah, you may call me an idealist, and I agree, okay? I'm a socialist for sure, but I think what you really require to look is to look at society at large and address those issues before moving forward to put solutions like this in order to improve society. Genetic diseases may not need to be debilitating. Patients with hemophilia and thalassemia can lead fulfilling life when there are social structures, good medical support is in place. At the end of the day, the stakeholder finally is the person with the disability, and who are we to really judge that a child with a Down syndrome and autism is less happy or contented in their life than what we would consider as a normal person? And it's also noteworthy to note that mutations, some of the mutations that predispose to genetic disease such as sickle cell anemia, may also provide some kind of population benefits, such as resistance to malaria. Okay, so editing up one disease could really therefore backfire by increasing the risk of another in the long run. Okay, and again, this is conjectural. And the case for evolution and natural selection may not be an end despite all of scientific progress. So really, germline, when we talk about germline editing, changing embryos, it really requires us to re-examine to attitudes and what kind of people matter in this world. Is gene editing going to be a convenient way of us eliminating a perceived problem rather than actually addressing the crux issues of the needs of the individual and the needs of society and the inclusive in the making and society completely and inclusive? The worry I have is that with this over-medicalization and commoditization of genomic variations, this would actually divert our care, access, and attention away from that actual vulnerable population. Okay. I hope I have convinced you somewhat that at the end of the day, you need to do social restructuring rather than jump lock, stock, and barrel into gene editing. Thank you.
Thank you, Prof. Vera. Now, Prof. Imam. Oh, okay. Prof. Vera. It's not individualized medicine anymore. We're talking about beta thalassemia, Prof. Vera. We're talking about cancer gene. And here we are living longer and then dying of cancer, right? So this is more than just individualized personal medicine. Nobody dare to say we should change our genes. Unfortunately, you're all too late. We're too late. We're already changing genes. When Prof. Vera said, look, we have no aim. We do have an aim. We are proactive community and we want to begin with the end in mind. The end in mind is reducing mortality and the burden of suffering, which we have done to a certain extent to a lot of other things. In obs and gynes, maternal mortality, right? So we've done a lot of these other community restructuring. Right now, we have developed our technology and knowledge to go further. We're going to test the science and our boundaries, okay? God is helping us. God is on our side, okay? We are not playing God because what we are given to play with, the technology and knowledge we have is just like little toys that's given to a two-year-old so that a two-year-old doesn't choke themselves, all right? With nothing like playing God, it is not about creating designer babies. Now, we go to a history of CRISPR. It started from 1987, right? But let me stop there at around 2004. It was about human genetic variation. We already identified genes that cause diseases. Some of the genes appear in clusters. You see them in racial groups, and you see differences in outcome of diseases by racial groups because they come in clusters. You've inherited these traits. And where you have preservation of beneficial mutations, like those who develop sickle cell diseases are protected from malaria. We also now have the elite HIV groups that will never develop AIDS. These are the ones, genes that are being passed down. They have some mutations in them that have been passed down to be beneficial for the society that survived because they are the ones that live. And then we have the elimination of the adverse mutations happen spontaneously. That is why genetic disorders are so rare. They have self-eliminated, right? Years ago, 130,000 years ago, where all people lived in one zone of the world, in Africa, one tribe had crossed out of Africa and they break up and travel across the rest of the world. We came from the same particular tribe that have moved and traveled around. But despite that, you can now identify your ancestors by genetic polymerase tests. And these genes are also the same genes that can actually change your medical problems. People of different racial group react differently to antihypertensives. So having this knowledge is good because we are able to change the treatment. You have different racial group ethnicity. We give a different sort of antihypertensives, beta blockers. or ACE inhibitors, you need to know that it's different in outcomes. So when you have clusters, it's not personalized medicine anymore. When you are able to alter the genetic structure of a particular disease, then you're able to tailor a different medical treatment. Because if you have altered, you either change their medical treatment by what problems they have, or you can alter their genetic problems so that they don't have the same problems. Those are choices that we have to us. But if you take that choice out, you cannot proceed to your frontiers and you cannot develop yourselves. And the bottom line is we need to tailor by our differences. And it could be at individualized level for those with high burden of disease, or it could be by group, the whole of thalassemia population, for example. So then this has led to CRISPR next, changing and editing the gene which is wrong. Now, when you talk about designer babies, sorry lah, I'm sorry, all of us were designer babies at one point. All of us were. But we don't make use of our full talents. None of us. You see, you got sprinter legs, but nobody want to run. Useless, right? You got 20/20 vision, but you're staring at an iPad, sampai mata pun rosak. Useless. You have, you know, low risk of breast cancer and stroke, but we makan sampai gemuk. So what? You know, there's no such thing as designer babies. I'm telling you now. Parents were trying to create this will fail. Hard work beats talent. You've heard all of this before, right? Whatever talent or uniquity you have in your genes is nothing if you don't make full use of it. There is no such thing as designer babies. Now we are talking about ethics. Let the ethics people do their work. But present the argument to them at an individual level who needs this. Ethics people can say no or yes, it doesn't matter. But it doesn't mean to say we should not do it at all. And there are laws in place for CRISPR embryos. It's okay. Laws also change. It doesn't mean to say if some countries have laws against this, we should not do anything. All right? We can still continue our hard work to advance our knowledge and technology. Let the ethics people do their work. Let the law people make their laws. Things will eventually change later on. It doesn't mean to say we should never start or do anything. Whatever we do, we can only do when we work together.
But before we let you go, don't forget, if you miss any part of the show, you can always download the podcast from our BFM app. And I'm Lim Soon Heng with
Tina Camilla.
And this has been Health and Living on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.